bells me.
What the fuck's the matter with these cunts? What's the matter with them? That must be on some fucking mega ego trip, these guys.
We got horses and bloody ducks.
The whole part of being a rock star is being a rock star. And what the rock stars do, you get a limo, you get a Learjet, you got people running around licking your ass.
I get nicknamed Nibby.
I looked at Bill Ward and he had this big long beard. And I said, you look like a pen nib. A stone.
Hello, I'm Ozzy.
It's very strange. And Geezer in particular had all sorts of weird dreams and weird thoughts. And it might have been the acid, I don't know. Blah, 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 blah.
Listen, we all, it's a sabotage. Welcome to Sabbath Bloody Podcast, a sabography for the masses. This is the sixth offering from the Sabbath here, and it's our seventh episode, if you count the pre-roll, the gloriously punny-titled LP, Sabotage. One that a lot of you consider the last classic Sabbath album, it seems. You know, the only trust the first six, man. Now, I can't say that I'm in that camp myself, but this is a very important album in their trajectory. An important document, perhaps their most, like, autobiographical offering, for lack of a better term there. A lot of interesting things to unpack with this one, so let's get into it. I've been looking forward to this point of the show. I haven't really done a proper deep dive into Sabotage myself, to be honest. And this is one of the ones that I've kind of slept on as far as the classic Aussie stuff. Always liked Symptom, always liked Hole in the Sky, but never had the full play on CD or tape. Well, I probably listened to it through file sharing and stuff, but I never actually had the CD or tape in my collection. Unlike the other five albums that I played the shit out of and owned in multiple formats, this one has tracks that I haven't even heard until a week or so ago. I stayed in the paranoid Master of Reality, Sabbath Bloody Sabbath camp as my go-tos, you know, just for what my dumbass wanted to hear over and over and over as a kid. Much like Volume 4, actually, which is now top 3 Sabbath for me since doing this deep dive on the show. Much like that album, though, there's a whole new respect that I have since taking this journey here for the glorious mess that they've presented us with here in Sabotage. That's part of this journey here, too, so songs like Megalomania and Thrill of It All, those are ones that I don't really recall from previous listens, but holy shit, man, like, not to bury the lead, but Thrill of It All, man, that's been on repeat for this guy, proving the point that all Sabbath is worth a couple of revisits. So from this point forward, there'll be a whole bunch of new songs for me to discover, and that's what this is all about, getting away from the standards, and I'm re-engaging with the albums and the as a full play. Like, I've even taken the hipster plunge into buying vinyl. My first purchases were all of Sabbath ones that they had at Golden Discs here in Dublin, Ireland, so off to a good start. Got my master, got my Sabbath Bloody Sabbath, even a little Tech X in there, technical ecstasy. But that's jumping ahead here. Enough of my ramblings, let's get into Sabotage. And listeners, be forewarned, there's going to be some legal battles here, some behind the music, real, you know, nasty shit here. So it's important that I highlight how good the overall output was musically from them around this time. Don't let the offstage drama taint how incredible some of these tracks are on this song and how great they were live. If anything, it's kind of providing the gas that's thrown on the fire here, I think. As far as them elevating their game, especially Ozzy on this album. I think this is peak for him as far as how much he's pushing his voice. He definitely refines it a little bit more, even in the next few albums after this. I find his voice kind of matures a bit more, but this is him just, you know, letting loose, turning it to 11. The DIY vibe to the production too. Unlike the debut, which is DIY kind of as well, and Paranoid even, but the songs seem far less rehearsed, if that makes sense. They feel assembled in post-production more than anything. There are a couple of tracks, of course, that they were playing live, and they did apparently workshop these songs in Ozzy's home studio. But the whole thing kind of has like a badass kind of demo vibe to it, like the album itself. And we'll get into the real reasons behind that shortly, but first, we got to talk about their live show around this time. 74 to 75, that's peak live Sabbath, in my very humble opinion anyway. So Let's get that caravan on its way.
It is a funny story. I think those stories are kind of best in the caravan.
The gigs we covered last episode were from the 73 tour, so in support of Sabbath Bloody Sabbath to some extent, which ended in Newcastle, March 18th, 1973. And as mentioned, they were all pretty burnt out at that point. They ended up canceling a shit ton of gigs and didn't really get out the full tour for Sabbath Bloody Sabbath until the start of 74, really. But when they emerged from the Clerwell Haunted Castle sessions there, they were given a great big major gig to get them back in the spotlight. The iconic Sabbath moment. Huge US festival at the Ontario Speedway, and that is Cal Jam. Now, Cal Jam is still going to this day, I believe, and it deserves a deep dive in itself, really, but for today, we're just going to say huge attendance there. Over 250,000 is what they say. Parts of Sabbath's performance were also broadcast on American television at the time, so you can check out the performance on YouTube, kind of pro shot footage, which is fucking incredible. There's a great cut of Killing Yourself to Live on there, so early vibes, you know, stuff that they, from the Sabbath Bloody Sabbath album. The Children of the Grave is incredible that they do there, and there's some great moments with Ozzy just acknowledging how awestruck he is from the masses of people. You can really see the excitement in all the lads. And also on that bill was ELP. Deep Purple blew up the stage, apparently. It's a really iconic gig, worth checking out. I'll give you the set list really quick here. Tomorrow's Dream is what they open with. Sweet Leaf, Killing Yourself to Live. War Pig, Snowblind, Sabracadabra they do with some jams. And they go into a big jam in the spirit of the California Jam, man. So some drum solos. Little blues cover thrown in there with Sometimes I'm Happy, which is a little ditty that they do a lot, actually. Becomes kind of a staple in their set around this time. They riff on, like, Supernaut, Iron Man, back into the Sabracadabra reprise, so proper jam. They play Orchid too. Paranoid closes the set, but they come back for an encore, and this is cool. The encore is Embryo into Children of the Grave, so check out that one on YouTube. You can tell that that's the encore too, because it's when they bring it hard. Ozzy D cloaks, and you know, it's pretty awesome here. I got a little bit here from Ozzy's book just talking about that gig. I'll read that out quickly here. When we did the Cal Jam Festival at Ontario Motor Speedway in 1974, for example, there was all kinds of bullocks going on backstage with the other bands. Things like, well, he had a pinball machine, and I want a pinball machine. Or, if he has a quadraphonic sound system, then I want a quadraphonic sound system. People were starting to think they were gods. I mean, the scale of Cal Jam thing was unbelievable. About 250,000 fans with performances simulcast on FM radio and on the ABC TV network. Rock and roll had never been done on that scale before in the States. You should have seen the rig that Emerson, Lake, and Palmer had. Halfway through their set, Keith Emerson did a solo on the grand piano while it was lifted off the stage and spun end over end. We hadn't played live for a while, so we rehearsed in our hotel room without any amps. The next day, we flew in by helicopter because all the roads were blocked. Then we ripped through our set with me wearing those silver moon boots and yellow leggings. So there you go. Cal Jam, big moment, great live Sabbath. So the rest of 1974, despite the lads being in prime touring shape from what I've seen and heard, Sabbath's touring lightened up then, and this was in part due to around this time they discovered the ugly truth about just where all their money was going, or not going, and it wasn't going to them. It's been hinted at before since fucking Master of Reality that this lineup doesn't last forever, and it's really the management and the shady deals that fuck with the band's vibes. That and substance abuse, sure, but mostly the crooks managing their shit, at least the way I see it. Their management company at the time, Worldwide Artists, fronted by Patrick Meehan Jr., it comes to light around this time that they were being scammed in a big way. Apparently Meehan was taking the lion's share and putting it into other ventures, including a hotel chain and some real mobster shit claiming in here. And basically, they noticed this mostly at Cal Jam. I mean, boys questioned their payouts for that show. They only got like $1,000 each, and they found out that it was like $250,000 that was given to the band to play the show. I mean, and only getting $4,000 of that, right there, they took notice. Even as drugged out and crazy as they are, they can notice when that kind of cashola is being missed. And although they were getting those drugs and the rented mansions and the recording sessions and stuff all covered, old Meehan was living the high life in comparison. And again, Ozzy said in his book here, it suddenly occurred to me that when I went to the office in London one day, Patrick Meehan got this whole fucking block of offices and Rolls Royces for days, all this shit and fucking different agencies and whatever. And it doesn't take a cunt to go, hang on, he's got four Rolls Royces and I'm still in a VW. You know, he would get coke for us whenever we wanted. If we wanted money, he'd give it to us eventually. He wouldn't give us like 20 grand or 50 grand, but if you wanted like 1,000 quid or 5,000 quid, he'd give it to you, you know? But he'd always have control over you. So when the axe did fall, who was the first to go under? It was us, not him. He saved his own arse. Ozzy says it pretty well there. Iommi echoes those kind of statements in his book as far as him knowing that that's he had to separate from Meehan. I also found when they tried to call Meehan out on the lack of payout they were getting, that just brought up the blinders, and they saw how ensnared they actually were by everything about him. Everything was tied up in shady contracts, right down to where they were living. So they would have to pay through the ass to get away from him even, and the band spent a fortune in legal fees. The most damaging of all, they didn't even own their own music by the end of it. It would be years before Black Sabbath would be free from these worldwide artist contracts that Meehan had, and Meehan would continue to profit off of their back catalog with a string of low-quality compilation albums throughout the 80s and even in the 90s, and terrible pressings of the classic albums, which obviously deserve much more. I mean, you're talking basically, I think Paranoid was the first one that was like under his control, and I think he acquired the debut as well somehow through the deals getting him from Jim Simpson. So basically everything up to this point. The first six Meehan, the only ones that matter according to most fans. But I'm not sure actually about the debut. That might still be Jim Simpson, because he did come back into the picture around this time, kind of in a bad way, actually. It was Black Sabbath versus Jim Simpson. That escalated again in 74, 75. There's another settlement there, more or less in Simpson's favor. He receives a payoff for wrongful termination back in the day. I don't know what happens with the catalog at that point, or if there's any assets that way, but I do know that the band themselves took a hit, as well as Meehan separately, because they were battling on the side. Like, just a complete mess. So Sabbath needed a big swing of dick to come in, bail them out of all this shit. Some big money needed to come in their corner, so cue that theme for The Godfather. Don Arden, who we had mentioned back on the Master of Reality episode, the mobster, gangster man who was trying to court Sabbath back in 70, he comes back into the picture, and actually, he was always kind of in the picture, you know, with his former employees, Meehan and Wilf Pine, who was the partner with Meehan at the beginning there. Also, Tony had kind of remained friendly with him despite turning down his original offer. Arden was always kind of in the picture, and he was notorious for not letting a grudge go. So I think most of his motivation was to come in and not only get Sabbath as a property, but, you know, shut down old Meehan for turning on him, man. He turned on the family. And as the story goes, in early 1975, Tony Iommi went to see the Don, pleading for help and sorting out all of Sabbath's own disastrous dealings. And he becomes kind of the money man behind him. They don't sign to his label or anything. Don is there, and he becomes a big part of everything.
Power of the Rift compels me.
Won't you listen?
Alright, Sabotage comes out of the gate with this heavy classic, Hole in the Sky. Just incredible, right? Right off the bat, gotta give this one top riff honors for today.
Power of the Riff compels me!
It just swings like no other, this one. The whole Sabotage album is in C-sharp tuning, I believe. They figured out what was working for the Doom, and this riff is just fucking pummeling, opening up. And I've kind of hinted at it in past episodes that Ozzy really hits his stride too here vocally on this LP. And he's ascending to fucking greatness on this track, right through the hole in the sky. Just pitch perfect 70s Sabbath here. Great opening number, picking up from Sabbath Bloody Sabbath nicely. They're almost like sister albums to me, I find. They pair very well together, which is funny because they actually took more time in between the two albums this round. Because you had like the debut and Paranoid were the same year, and then Master was the year after that. Right through to Sabbath Bloody Sabbath, it was all in a row, 71, 72, 73. And then they took a full year off before they hit Sabotage in 75. So, still not that long between in the grand scheme of things, but 70s rock, man, it was all about pumping out at least one album a year, sometimes two. One thing that's always kind of puzzled me about this track here is coming out of Hole in the Sky, there's a real hard out where it kind of cuts mid-riff straight into that acoustic interlude of Don't Start Too Late. It's kind of jarring and it sounds like a mistake almost, but it must have been intentional, right? It's always kind of thrown me for a loop. At this point, I kind of like it, but it just irked me when I first heard the album. Tony has mentioned that there was a bunch of engineering problems going on in Sabotage, so maybe that has something to do with it here. Honestly, I would have liked to have seen Hole in the Sky and Symptom just back-to-back on this LP to open. Maybe drop that little interlude after that barrage. Use it to kind of tee up Megalomania. Or even bump up something from the B-side, like Thrill of It All into that four slot or something like that. I don't think the Sabotage, in my opinion, is very well sequenced. All right, that's really the only thing I hold against it, because the back end of it, it kind of loses you, and they have the right closer, but anyway. Hole in the Sky is great, and from there they go to the Don't Start Too Late. There's a couple of notes in here that I've written down for this little interlude that we get. The title, Don't Start Too Late, is a reference to the new recording engineer that the Sabs had in the fold, so he was always telling them off for kicking in too early before he could roll the tape, like, don't start yet, lads. Fuck, too late. They're fucking riffing again. And the whole point of these little interludes are to kind of journey through the album as you would with the vinyl back in the day. So I can't really dissect them as full-on songs, but as far as the Tony-fronted, guitar-driven interludes, I'd say that this is one of the weaker ones. And again, just like Hole in the Sky slam cuts into it, there's another slam cut out of it that goes into the next song, which is one of Sabbath's most metal riffs of all time. Let's just fucking hit it. Yeah, Symptom of the Universe. Again, no complaints here. It's just, Don't Start Too Late seems to be kind of spliced in between, especially with the hard outs and the jump cuts. The transitions in the front part of this album are not so hot. It's very strange, especially since on side B, they're all about the big intertwined transitions, the slow fades, like from Am I Going Insane to The Writ. So is that part of the whole concept of the album? I don't know. Maybe the beginning is supposed to feel like that and it sinks into it. It just kind of sticks out for me. I know, I should be talking more about the fucking songs here, like this fucking riff here. Let It Go, man. Kinds of great changes in this one. There's a big fucking jazzy breakdown that's just full of ear candy on later listens, I find. Like the first time you listen to this track, you're like, no, stay in that heavy shit, man. Stay on that Judas Priest riff that you have there. But on repeat listens, I'm finding that I enjoy the jazzy parts more. I find new little things in there all the time. Ozzy's doing all kinds of crazy little vocal things. And so They're like Easter eggs, you know? Symptom is known as the riff monster, but really, there's all kinds of classical flavor in here as well. So, the first side of Sabotage is really just straight fire, because the next up is maybe their longest track, but it's a fucking cool one to burn down. All kinds of powerful riffs in here. Megalomania. Such a plodding song. It sounds like some of the stuff that we'll get into in the Dio era, the big sprawling epics. They should have done this track with Dio, actually. Megalomania surprisingly even got into the live sets. I mean, for a 9-minute plus song to slip into a set when they already had so many great albums to draw from, that says something about the power of this song and how much they enjoy playing it. The Sabotage album has a through line of the lads kind of rejecting fame and kind of going more underground, getting pissed about how much hassle all the exposure has caused, and wanting to get back to the roots kind of thing, you know, more money, more problems kind of thing. Megalomania kind of ties into that nicely, I think. And the lyric, to me, it sounds like some kind of rejection of fame maybe, right? Let's read this one out. How can this poison be the dream of my soul? How did my fantasies take complete control? Why don't you just get out of my life? Why doesn't everybody leave me alone? Like, Ozzy's just fucking telling you to fuck off. And don't ask him either, because he doesn't know. I think he should bust this one out in his Sabbath covers and his solo set now. Maybe on the final tour. I'm sure that Zach and Blasco would have no problem rocking this one for him. So the A side is pretty stellar on Sabotage, but it's the B side that kind of loses me a little bit. Ultimately ranks this album much lower than its predecessors for me. I know a ton of people, Sabotage is like their jam. But for me, aside from the closing track, which is one of my favorite of all time, I probably never flip this record over. The closing track is never to be skipped, though. So we'll burn through these other three first here. So what do you got here? The B-side opens with The Thrill of It All. Here, there's actually an excerpt from Tony's book again, where he's speaking directly about making this track. He says, "We had a hard time recording Thrill of It All, and eventually we got it down after no end of takes. Soon after, we went to the bar across the road to play darts, and Dave Harris, the tape guy, came over and said, 'We've got a problem.' I said, 'What?' He said, 'One of the technicians has aligned the tapes on the master tape.' 'You're kidding.' 'I'm not, honestly. Their job was to put a series of reference tones, basically a bunch of beeps going from higher to lower pitches, on the master tape, so it's all aligned and ready for you to use. You had to do that in those days, align the heads and everything, make sure it was all right. He would set it up on the tape machine and go, 'That's fine, you can use it.' But he had mistakenly put the tones over the master tape of Thrill of It All. We listened to the recording of the song and suddenly it was, 'Doot, doot, doot.' He wiped enough off so we had to record the whole thing again. It was such an ordeal. We didn't kill Dave, but we actually gave him a nod for his screw-up on the album sleeve. Tape operator and saboteur, Dave Harris." So there you go, Dave Harris. He might have also been responsible for those abrupt cuts at the front of the album too, right? Maybe. I'll have to do one of those hashtag Ask Iommi's about that. That's a good question for him. So next on the album, they hit us with what eventually became Sabbath's big opening track for live performances. They're kind of Ecstasy of Gold, to bring it back to Metallica for you guys. And it's fucking great for that. Super Czar. Some people hate this cut, but I think it's fucking cool though. So I'm going to give it its due here. And the riff by itself, that's heavy as fuck, right? ¶¶ So, some quotes from its architect, Tony Iommi, since I already have the book out here in front of me. I wrote Superzar at home with a Mellotron. Oh, God. There it is again. The Mellotron. Jesus Christ. Okay. A Mellotron to create those choir sounds. I put heavy guitar to that, and it really blended well. I thought, I'd love to try this in the studio, and it would be great if we could use a real choir. So I booked the London Philharmonic Choir. They came down and were all set up at like 9 o'clock in the morning. Ozzy didn't know anything about this, and when he walked in, he saw all these people, and he walked out again. Fucking hella. It's the wrong studio. It's funny how humble these guys are in the process of making these albums, yet they're doing some serious music stuff here. I mean, bringing in the London Philharmonic. That's pretty big shit. And some of the stuff could actually come off as pretentious if in the wrong hands, done by U2 or something like that. But they're just such great crack about it. Like, there's even stories from back in Volume 4, Ozzy humming the string parts out to Will Malone and the full orchestra playing it, and him just sitting there beaming like a young lad off his fucking trolley on Charlie. I love that kind of shit, though. Superzar has that feel to me, the boys having fun creating something outside of the norm. And they use it a lot live, too. Well into the Tony Martin, and I think even in the Dio eras, actually, they play it over the PA while they take to the stage. I will admit, it's a little out of place on the record, especially in the number 6 slot here, the B-side. It would have been great to just open the album with it, I think. But I guess hitting you with the hole in the sky straight away is pretty effective too, right? It's epic, just kind of out of place on the album. The next track, however, wouldn't work in any spot. We'll burn this one down quickly. And a deep breath and a swig of beer for courage, because I think this is my least favorite Black Sabbath track of all. Definitely of the Ozzy stuff. I mean, sure, there's probably some Glenn Hughes crap that's a lot lower. But Am I Going Insane Radio? Jesus. Even the title just makes me cringe. Am I Going Insane Radio? What does it mean, man? Did they design this one for radio? Anyway, the chorus is okay, I guess, but it's kind of all ruined by the overly notey part that Geezer plays there. He just sinks any lift that the song has with that boo doo 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 doo. And everything about the song is just garbage to me. I'm sorry if you disagree. The best thing about this track is that it's fucking short. And the laughter at the end, how it leads into our closing track. That's amazing. I guess if this is the worst of the fully fleshed out Ozzy era Sabbath, then they're doing something right, because it's not that terrible of a song. But there's a big, long transition out of it that leads us to the best track off the album. All is well that ends well, right? I'm just laying it all down for this one. The Writ. Musically, it's awesome too. Bill and Geezer do some great things. Geezer's really leading this one with a killer bass effect. Apparently a pedal called a techno brain that does this weird kind of envelope filter. All kinds of cool production tricks on the Writ, from Geezer's envelope filter to the straight 70s backwards hi-hat and cymbals that Nibby's doing. The lads are getting tricky on this one. It's great. Playing with the gear some. This song is very much the theme of the album, too. In a way, Sabotage is kind of a concept album at the end of things. Maybe it's more autobiographical. If you're like me and you had no idea what a fucking writ was, it's probably a good thing, because it's basically being served papers, so you don't want to come across a writ in your life. Anyway, the track was also penned by Geezer and Ozzy in the studio, inspired by the fact that Patrick Meehan had issued them another writ while they were recording. So the lyrics are these. Ladies digging gold from you, will they still dig now that you're through? Which I think is more directed to ex-wives there. Vultures sucking gold from you, will they still suck now that you're through? So some fucking real life shit in these lyrics, lads. No sugarcoating with weed and wizards and fairies in this one. It's straight up, fuck you, Patrick Meehan. I have a quote too from Ozzy's book, actually, to put this whole Meehan situation to rest. For today, anyway, because he continues to fuck with them well into the 80s. And also, this will close this segment out, so I'll read it out again from Ozzy's book, I Am Ozzy, talking about the Rit. I wrote most of the lyrics myself, which felt a bit like seeing a shrink. All the anger I felt towards Meehan came pouring out. But you know what? All that bullshit he pulled on us didn't get him anywhere in the end. You should see him now. He looks like a fat, boozy old fuck. But I don't hate him. Hating people isn't a productive way of living. When it's all said and done, I don't wish the bloke any harm. I'm still here, you know? I still have a career. So what's the point in hating anyone? There's enough hate in the world as it is without me adding to it. And I got a song out of it, at least. And what a fucking song. So that's The Great Sabotage.
Check me out on Twitter at SabbathBladePC or email SabbathBladePodcast@gmail.com. Blow on a jug. Bog blast. Oh, yeah.